Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Jim Potts back on the air, and as always, thank you so much for sharing your Sunday evening with me. I really appreciate that. Well, hey, today, believe it or not, for those of you that are my faithful listeners out there, today represents 52 shows, which equals 1 year. So today is my 1 year anniversary in terms of doing these this radio show. It's really been an exciting experience. I thank you all for listening and keep tuning into me every week, sending me those emails. So thank you so much. And also for my call-ins as well. Okay, look, you know, we got a number of things to talk about. For those of you that got my email blast, you know what the areas where we're going to discuss. Before I get into that, though, I do want to give you my phone number here, 818-602-4929, in case anybody wants to call in, because we're going to be talking about some different sensitive areas today. And you can also just find out on the website as well. So if you just go to the website, you're good to go. Also, if you want to send me an email like so many people do, send me an email at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. That's listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. And, of course, if you want to get on my email blast to get the topics for the upcoming shows, just text Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and just simply enter your email address. Again, text Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and enter your email address. And then you'll get the topics beforehand. Okay, you know, originally when we did the email blast, we said we were going to be talking about the average police response time, et cetera, and the different types of terrorism, which is what we're going to do today. But first is what I'm going to do is address, as always, some emails that I got. And the first email has to do with this, actually with this Virginia, you know, situation with the shooting. But Jim, how many times have you said, don't think it can't happen to you, and now another active shooter in the workplace? 12 people dead from a disgruntled employee. Keep the message coming, Jim. And that's from Celeste from Silver Springs, Maryland. But you know what? Here's what we have to talk about a little bit on this, Celeste. First of all, the you know, arguably, yes, it's a disgruntled employee, and yes, we're going to spend a little bit more time on this because this is also coincidentally a hot topic, obviously, because this just took place. Now, for what people may not know, and I think some of this might be coming out now, is that this individual had actually given his resignation a couple of hours before by email. So he had resigned. So we're not sure about him being disgruntled. I mean, obviously there's an issue, he's an active shooter. But let me just tell you, they said that there was nothing on the table regarding getting ready to terminate him. He didn't have any disciplinary actions against him. There was nothing. There was no pending issues or anything. So quite frankly, when those kind of situations do happen, we're somewhat dumbfounded as to why a person that worked on the job, I think he worked on the job for, I don't know, 15 years, whatever it was. It was a substantial amount of time. And, you know, from their perspective, he didn't have any issues. So it's a little bit surprising that he just opened up fire like that, in all honesty. We're just not sure of the whys at this point. And as things start to come out, Celeste, we'll probably find out a little bit more. For those of you that didn't keep up with this, he was a long-term employee, and it was a government building. And 12 people did get killed, that's for sure. And he was eventually shot and killed by the police. Now, there were four other people that were wounded in that shooting, including a police officer. Unfortunately, he had a bulletproof vest on that saved his life. Now, the mayor, Mayor Dyer, you know, he stated it was the most devastating day in the history of Virginia Beach. You know, now, I'm going to tell you, this is what I keep trying to get across to people about these things. I always say, and for those of you that are regular listeners, but also the people out there that have heard me in my active shooter training, what do I always say? Don't ever think it can't happen to you. This is a prime example. Now, I've been to Virginia Beach. It is a nice community. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, you wouldn't expect this, but you can't say that these days. It can be anywhere. And people have to be prepared. Now, this particular shooting happened around 4 p.m. And he was a veteran, by the way, of the Public Utilities Department there. But he entered the building in the city's municipal center and just immediately began shooting people indiscriminately at different people. That's the sad thing, is that there's people there that didn't do any harm to him at all, and he just starts firing. Now, my understanding is he was also using some handguns. As I understand it, the handguns that he was using, I believe, were also legally purchased. So if anybody wants to weigh in on that issue, that would be great to hear from the, you know, from the listeners. The reason why I say that is because, as you know, that there's been a lot of controversy regarding this business about, you know, gun control, et cetera. And here's a perfect example where an individual legally purchases his weapon. Now, you know, the governor weighed in and said it's a very bad tragedy. I mean, Virginia, you don't really always hear about these kind of things out of Virginia. Now, basically, is what they said was that it was unbelievable for something like this to happen because it's a large, pretty common, peaceful place to live. And, you know, once again, those are the things that happen, and you cannot be surprised by these things. You have got to be prepared for these things. It's just that simple. So, you know, the other thing that I had heard was that they had just done active shooter training as well. So that's interesting, because I also know that's what they did. They barricaded themselves in. About 20 people barricaded themselves in a room and put desks and things against the door, which is what we tell people to do also in the active shooter training. You got to do what you got to do. And, you know, out of sight, out of mind type of thing. Now, in this particular case, is what was also good, was that the police response time. Now, this was a government building. So the police response time, and I'm assuming that the police department was not that far away when they got the 911 call, and they responded within 2 minutes. And the police basically rushed in, which appears to be what their MO is these days. They're just going to rush in and start trying to do what they can to subdue the situation. And he actually got into a gun battle with them. So that was, you know, sad all the way around. The one thing that we never like about the fact that the active shooters sometimes is trying to find out why people do these kind of things. And sometimes there's no rhyme or reason. I mean, you know, here's people that have lost their lives, and we may not ever know. I know the police searched his home, et cetera, so there may be more details coming out at some particular time. What I thought was interesting is the fact that he resigned by email a couple of hours before. I mean, if he was going to do this, I mean, why is he so much concerned about, you know, sending in a letter of resignation, whatever the case may be? I know one of the witnesses said that we tried to do everything we could to keep, you know, everybody safe, and we were all just terrified. It felt like it was a dream. It wasn't really happening. We got a call coming in right now, so let's address that. Hi, you're live on the air with Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share?
Yeah, Jim. Last time I talked to you, I remember I'm from New Jersey. I said in New York they say if you see something, say something. I was saying there's always a red flag. And what's scary about the situation at Virginia Beach is so far anyway, until there's more investigating, obviously, but so far, it doesn't look like there was any red flag. They talked to his neighbors, and they were shocked and, you know, surprised. And I don't know. I don't know what to say. The guy purchased the guns illegally, and maybe there's something that they haven't found out yet. I don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, it's true that when these things happen, how many times do we actually see on the news where friends and neighbors and family members do state that they're shocked? Because there aren't any signs. I know that from our perspective at Potts & Associates, when we do the active shooter training and we meet with the managers, we give the managers the 8 common signs to look out for. So there are some red flags that we have out there that we expect and hope that people will notice. You know, one of them is when a person is kind of off to themselves, they don't communicate with others. You know, they may have these personal issues that are going on, et cetera. But again, you know, with this situation, everybody's just that. They're just shocked. And they said he was a longstanding employee on my way over here. I had information and learned information that he had resigned a few hours before. They said that there was absolutely no issue with his performance. They said it was satisfactory. And like I was just saying a few minutes ago, is that it's sad sometimes with these things that we'll actually never know what was on the person's mind. It's amazing.
Doesn't it make you wonder, though? He didn't just go out and buy a gun this past week. He bought a gun last year. He bought a gun in 2016. And I guess I heard they found more guns in his home. So maybe he'd been thinking about this for a long time. Who knows? Maybe I tend to think somebody like this might have had a death wish too, because why would you? I mean, granted, he did work there, but the police department was right across the street.
Yeah, that's why there was a 2-minute response time. I kind of assumed some of that they were close by. But go ahead. So you're saying he wanted maybe death by cop?
Maybe wanted a death. Maybe had a death wish because he knew the cops were right across the street. They're going to be there in 2 minutes, and he's probably going to end up in a gunfight with them. And probably lose.
You know, what you're saying is logical, but here's the part that always disturbs me. If somebody really wants to end their life for whatever reason that they want to end their life, I don't understand why they would want to take other people with them. I mean,
yeah, I don't understand that either.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're not psychologists or anything like that, and maybe one day I can maybe get somebody on the air that could, a psychologist that could talk about that, because you have to wonder. This business about death by cop. Death by cop is not a new thing, obviously. Even having been a police officer for all those years, I mean, we hear those kind of things. You see things like that on the news when you tell a person to be compliant and not compliant, and they come rushing towards you. They got to have a certain death wish, like you just said. But why not? I mean, I'm not into people killing themselves in terms of, you know, taking their own lives, et cetera. But if you really just want to get out of this world as we know it, why take all these other innocent people with you? I just don't understand that part of it.
I think most mass shooters, they know they're not going to get away. They know the police are going to show up. They're probably going to end up in a gunfight, probably die, maybe get captured, but probably die. So they know there's really not going to be any way out. But that's why I think some of these guys have had. They don't care. They don't care if they live or die. They just
Over the last couple of years, though, we've had some mass shooters, some of these church shooters that got caught and things of that nature. There was the one guy, I think it was North Carolina or Texas, I forget right now off the top of my head, where he got captured. But he, you know, some of these people are out there making statements. The ones that are making statements, they don't do that. They don't necessarily get into the gun battle thing. They try to get away, et cetera, and then they end up getting caught. And then you find out what it was all about. So when some of these guys shoot up the synagogues, as an example, and they get captured, then that was for religious reasons, and, you know, that's why they did it. So with them, we have an opportunity to find out, and I don't think they're looking necessarily to get killed. They're looking to make a statement. The ones that we don't get that from are the ones that when they go in and look at their computers, they do this, they do that, they can't find anything. Like Mr. Paddock out of Las Vegas. Nobody ever knows what was on his mind, and yet he killed all of those people, and we'll never know. And that's the sad part.
Well, I'm hoping they do find something with this guy, maybe some mental problem or something that they find out. Because it's scary that somebody could just snap like that, and they decide to just go kill a bunch of people.
And you know,
that's why you say it could happen anywhere. It could happen anywhere. Somebody who owns some guns, the mind just snaps for whatever reason and decides, well, I'm doing this. That's it.
But you know what? I did last year I did an episode on children, and they were, and one of the things that we find out with children is that children don't snap, as an example. So I have to wonder whether or not an adult snaps. Some of these adults, like the gentleman a couple of months ago that was up in, I think it was a warehouse situation, and he went in because he knew he was going to be terminated, and he went and killed the HR director, the director of operations, and an intern. Now, that person probably, quote-unquote, snapped because of the fact that, you know, he knew that he was going to get fired. This guy, there was no issue in terms of his work. His work was satisfactory. He wasn't on the bubble to be terminated. It was none of that. And he was a long-term employee. So I don't see him just snapping. Maybe he had, you know, sometimes people have health issues also. So maybe there was a health issue. Maybe that'll come out. But then that's a privacy issue, so it might not be released. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe in the next couple of weeks or so, when they finish their investigation, we'll have an opportunity to find out why. And, you know, the families of these individuals, I mean, my wife and I were looking at their pictures on the TV before we came out. And, you know, they're people from all different backgrounds. There's younger people, there's older people, there's white people, there's black people, there's different people from ethnic backgrounds and everything. So there's no, it doesn't appear to be a rhyme or reason in terms of anything like that. But, you know, like you said, and like I've said so many times on the air or in the trainings that we do, it's, you know, you just have to be prepared these days. You just cannot believe that this thing cannot happen to you. You're in a nice, quiet little town. You're in the suburbs, and this will never happen, you know, because that's just not the case. I'm actually, matter of fact, stay on the air real quick because I'm actually getting ready to read another email that's similar, and I'll read this to you. And this says, Jim, a small nearby town had an active shooter event at a Big Lots. No place is safe anymore. And this is in Lufkin, okay? Lufkin is in Texas. It says Lufkin is a quiet, peaceful place. But at least they got him before he killed his girlfriend or somebody else. Keep broadcasting. And this was signed off by John. So here we go, because I got that one actually before. I just read the other one first because it's the hot topic. But this one was actually before the one that just happened in Virginia. And on that particular note, that individual, it's the same thing. Now, with this particular person, though, what was it? It was a domestic violence situation. He was actually looking for his girlfriend because his girlfriend, I guess, had broken up with him. So he was there, and he had been warned. And his name was Regan Todd Horton. He's 48 years old. And he had been issued a trespass warning at approximately 4:45 because he had been harassing his former girlfriend while she was arriving at work. So he turned around and came back at 7 a.m. It was 4:45 a.m. And then he came back at 7 a.m. and shot out the glass of the at the side entrance and came into the store with a shotgun. So the one employee had escaped and called the police, and three employees got into a back room and locked the door. But here's another incident. But now this one, we know what the issue was. This one is a domestic violence situation that spills over into the workplace. And that's what we tell people. There's normally four incidents that has to do with this kind of behavior with the workplace, active shooters. Disgruntled former employee, disgruntled current employee, irate customer, or a domestic violence situation. With the West Virginia, with the Virginia issue, I don't know that it fell into any one of those categories, quite frankly. Because there's nothing that suggests
it's
still
disgruntled. Still early yet. That's the whole thing. It just happened 2 days ago. So,
right. So maybe
they may find out to talking to his doctor or whatever. Who knows? It might have been some reason. But you know, at least they had the shooter training recently too. And you think about it, people that say, well, they had the shooter training and 12 people died anyway. But if they hadn't had the active shooter training, it might have been 24 people that got killed or more.
And that's the point of why we talk when we're talking to people about the active shooter, when we do the active shooter training. That's exactly why we have that discussion, because the other thing that we tell them, there's no perfect scenario with this. There's no perfect defense to this. There's no perfect out to this. But that's why you just have to be aware as an individual that something like this may happen. And when it starts happening, go through the safety tips that we give you so that you can at least get by and save your life. Now, some people will turn around and ask us, well, wait a minute, you know, what about trying to save everybody else? Well, what did they tell you on the airplane when the oxygen mask flows down? Put the oxygen mask on yourself first, okay, and then everybody else is second. I hate to put it that way because, you know, but self-preservation for people, that's what it is. You've got to be prepared for this. And this hero's out there, and I think that's great. And I think that if somebody can help save other people's lives, like that student did not too long ago, he lost his life, but his other two co-students, you know, jumped on the guy, you know, and were able to get the gun away from him, and they saved lives. That does happen also. And that's admirable. I get it. But ordinarily, you're telling people, look, put into practice the safety tips. Think about self-preservation first, okay, and try to save other people, you know, second. So, at any rate, all right, Jim, I appreciate you calling in as always. And, you know, I'm going to get into the rest of this area here. Let's see what else we can talk about today.
Great. Can't wait. All right.
Take care. All right. Bye. You know, it's true, guys out there that are listening. You know, this is a tough one, and you really do feel sorry for the families out there now that have to mourn, and then they can't even get the questions answered, at least in terms of the whys. That makes it the toughest part, because then you don't have the closure that you would like to have. So, at any rate, we do want to express our condolences all to all those families out there in Virginia, and, you know, keep them in your prayers, whatever the case may be. Okay, let me go ahead and get to the third email that I wanted to talk to you about. You know, this business about, well, I'll read the email to you first. Jim, just wondering if you heard on the news about Texas legalizing open carry of firearms for a full week after a natural disaster. Does that make sense to you? I know you have discussed Second Amendment related issues, but this is just seems like it's crazy to me. It sounds like it could very easily be like vigilante justice. And you know what it's designed to do is to catch people who are trying to steal. What are your thoughts? And this is signed by Sam from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Sam, I will tell you, first let me update the listeners, because of the fact that the listeners might not know exactly what's going on with this. So what it is that Texas is about to legalize open carry of firearms for a full week, but it is after a natural disaster. And you know what they're trying to do with this. Some people say that, well, it's because they need to protect themselves. Well, the state lawmakers, first of all, you should be aware, Sam, narrowly passed that bill that would allow the gun owners to carry their weapons, open or concealed, and it is for a 7-day period. I know you said a week, but it's for a 7-day period, and it's during a state of emergency. Now, as what they're saying is that the change would even apply to bars and shelters if the operators of those premises choose to authorize the practice. Now, as always, there's more than one side to a story. The supporters of the bill argue that the change would provide clarity for lawful gun owners evacuating their homes during a natural disaster. Now, think about that for a moment, Sam. All right? Is what they're talking about is the fact that here I am. I'm a guy that has some weapons. I don't want to leave my weapon in my house under those circumstances. A, somebody could get those weapons, okay, because people will go into your house and steal, so now they've stolen your weapons. All right? So what they're doing is giving them an opportunity to be able to carry their weapons from point A to point B is the way I think it is. So I don't necessarily say it's for vigilante justice, although we do know in those disaster situations, there's a lot of things that are going on and people may not be safe. According to the bill, the Texans would really have the ability to take certain firearms with them because that way they wouldn't have the fear of breaking the law or being forced to leave handguns behind in their vehicles or homes, you know, because they could risk that, you know, that looters are going to steal them, was the bottom line. Now, the opponents of the bill say it's going to pose a public safety concern and place an additional burden on first responders during an already stressful situation. Now, when they're talking about, these responders, the first responders, they're talking about law enforcement officers, because now you've got gun-toting people, you know, carrying these guns, and now you got police officers possibly engaging them from a lot of different perspectives, and now they're going to have to be on guard to make sure that nobody gets accidentally shot. So anytime that you're starting to mix guns with all of this, I think there are some problems with that, Sam. So I'm not necessarily saying that I'm opposed to it, but you know, it's not really solving a problem. It may actually be creating a problem. You know, the situation is going to be very difficult for law enforcement, because instead of having to deal with rescuing people or even helping people, they're going to have to deal with situations of how to confront someone who's walking around with a gun. So now here they are. It's you know, they're walking around. They're carrying a weapon. Now the police officers are going to have to confront them to ask them, make the inquiries in terms of why are you carrying that weapon? And, you know, sometimes that could be a hostile situation. People could get upset. It could be problematic, in my opinion. Now, there are some that say that Texas should have the ability to take certain firearms with them in a mandatory evacuation, and I really do understand that. So it's really, you know, in some ways a flip of the coin. Now, I will tell you also, currently the Texans are not allowed to carry a firearm in public or have it in plain view in their vehicle unless they have a license to carry or do so in a shoulder or belt holster. And it's also a crime in that state to carry a handgun on certain premises, such as churches, schools, and hospitals. Now, under the first proposal that they submitted on this being passed, Sam, is that the restrictions would not apply if a licensed gun owner carries a handgun during a mandatory evacuation under a state of emergency or while returning to the evacuated areas. And also, gun owners would also be allowed to carry their weapons in places designated as shelters as long as the person operating those premises authorizes the practice. Now, the problem with that is that how are you going to know that when you go to the shelter that the shelter is authorizing? So suppose is what happens is that the shelter is not one that's going to authorize it, and now you've carried it from your home, you've gone to the shelter, and the shelter now turns around and says no. What are you going to do with the sidearm or the firearm that you're carrying? So as you can see, that ends up becoming problematic as well. So what do you say, Sam? How do I answer your question, Sam? I don't know. I think it's a flip of a coin, and I certainly understand both ways. From a law enforcement standpoint, I've got to go with I don't think that they should be able to do that. I think is what they need to do is secure their weapons in their homes, which a lot of people don't do. You have gun safes, as an example. If those things are in gun safes, nobody's going to be able to carry out that big, heavy gun safe. So look at it that way. And again, it's just my opinion, but I think it could create other problems with carrying guns around. And now if somebody gets killed, you know you're going to see it all on the news and it's going to be a mistake. Didn't intend it. This is what happened. And now local law enforcement is going to have to deal with those kind of issues. Okay? So, Sam, I hope that answers your question as best as I could. My opinion is I think it could open the door to other kinds of problems. And there's also, by the way, ways to disable weapons also. You can take the firing pin out. You can do a lot of different things that if you have to leave the home. So, and you can even put them on lockdown. Okay, well, we'll see how that turns out. Okay, let's get to the first main topic that I wanted to talk about today. The time has definitely moved on, but I want to talk about this, about the average police response time to 911 calls. The reason I want to talk about that is because I get a lot of discussions and emails where people are always talking about that they don't like the police response time to these 911 calls. So I've been asked that many times, and I get it. You call 911 and you expect an immediate response. You know, a lot of time that's not the case. Well, it's for a lot of different reasons, and I want to go through some of those reasons so at least you have a better understanding of what's going on. Why are they not responding as quick as you would like them to respond? Now, you got to understand also a lot goes on behind the scenes at the police station. You know, you got to understand that the processing of emergency phone calls isn't as simple as it seems. People call in, and I even talk to people about this in my active shooter classes, that when the adrenaline is pumping and you're upset and you're trying to give information out, you got to get a hold of yourself for a moment, slow down, take a deep breath, and be able to clearly give some information. The sooner you can do that is the sooner that the process can start being initiated so that you can get help. And I got to tell you, in fact, many of the calls dispatchers take aren't even true emergencies, and that's another problem. Case in point, I was briefed a few weeks ago, and I think I mentioned this on one of the other shows. We had an FBI briefing as well as from the SWAT team leader in the Las Vegas shooting. And, you know, the information that we were able to obtain that was given to us was that there were a lot of false calls. You know, they were saying that New York had 20 hostages with an active shooter. It wasn't true. Active shooters at the airport wasn't true. You know, so that's the other problem with the with these calls. People make these calls sometimes, so now the law enforcement is sidetracked by these calls. So these calls just slow down the process for those who truly need the help. Now, another common question is, what is the average police response time? Well, look, it depends. Let's go back to the Virginia Beach situation. The police office was right across, the police station was right across the street from the office. Well, that was 2 minutes. There's other towns where the towns are very small and they have a police force there. So it's going to vary. So what is the average response time? I can tell you it's normally should be about 10 minutes is how long you'd have to wait on the average for police to respond to a 911 call. Now, you might think you'd get an immediate response, but so do hundreds of others who are also calling 911, and that's what you have to think about. Now, I will say that the active shooter situations, they are really gearing up for that, and they are trying to get there quicker as well. Now, another common question is, what are the police response time rates, you know, highly dependent on? Well, the 10 minutes can feel like a lifetime, guys. I get that. But you got to consider some different factors that play a role in this. Well, the one thing is the priority of your emergency. Those are going to be listed as high, low, or somewhere in between. You got to understand what you think is an emergency, okay, and what the police think is an emergency is two different things. It may not be that that's a high priority call. You know, I think I hear a prowler, as opposed to, hey, there's a prowler coming through my front door. Okay, look at the difference. You know, so it's the priority of your emergency. And the police officers always have to look at the number of other high priority calls that are coming in at the same time. You know, you want the attention right then. And I get it. It could be a dangerous situation. I understand that. But it also depends on the number of police officers on duty at the time. All right, that's a consideration. You know, how many do we have on duty? 10? 15? How big is the city? Makes a difference. In addition to that, what we also have to take into consideration is the number of officers needed for the particular call. So if you have let's just call it a domestic disturbance, you know, a domestic disturbance and there's a weapon has been used or threatened to be used, we're not going to send one police officer over there. That call may take two, maybe three officers who are going to respond. You know, if you call us and tell us it's a priority because of the fact that your cat has been treed, okay, and you want your cat out of the tree, and let me just tell you, you may think that I'm being facetious with that, but people get calls like that. You know, how many times have you seen on the news where the fire department or police officer is trying to get some cat out of the tree? You know, but you think it's important because you don't want your cat to fall and get hurt, okay? So, you know, you got to understand that there's so many factors. Now, let's look at what 911 calls are considered high priority, because I think that's important. So every time you call 911, it's not high priority. The only high priority calls are those that have life-threatening issues. Life-threatening issues, guys. Next most important are calls that require immediate response, and included in those calls are those that pose a threat to property. So there's a difference for us between life and the protection of property. From there, honestly, the priorities decrease. Calls with the need for immediate attention, yet no immediate physical harm or damage is apparent. Hey, I'm telling you right now, it's going to take a little bit longer than that. Okay? Calls that don't need immediate response, but which could result in the apprehension of a suspect. Once again, that's what it is. Calls where assistance is necessary but don't pose any immediate danger. Those are all going to be low priority calls depending on what else comes in. Now, the one thing that's always bad is when we have a call and we respond to a domestic violence situation and we get there. And then I'll just say the woman, as an example, turns around and says, my husband has threatened, you know, that he's going to kill me. The sad part about it is that we have to ask, well, has he done anything? No. He just says he's going to. Well, guess what? What can we do with that call? You may feel very tense about it. We get it. But we just can't just take him to jail because you're saying something about what he's going to do. Then the next common part that comes to that, which is a secondary question, well, what if he kills me? Well, then we'll be able to do something. And I hate to put it that way. That I know that sounds harsh, but you got to understand everybody here has rights too. So that's what makes it a little bit tougher. Now, let's look at, in terms of the response time again, that when we investigate specific situations, security alarm is going off, domestic violence and robberies each have their own response time. Some may not rate as high on the scale as you think, even though in your eyes everything is an emergency. The police will see it differently. They get these calls all the time. So is what we say is that, look, you got to understand, what is the average police time when an alarm goes off? Let me just tell you, there's one problem with alarms. 94 to 98% of those activated alarms aren't real emergencies. They're false alarms. For those of you that have alarms, how many times do you actually set off your own alarm? Now, this slows down the police response time. Most alarm companies, you know, will at least call you by phone or via the two-way, you know, voice technology on your alarm, whatever the case may be. They'll even call your local police department if you don't answer or you confirm it's an emergency. You know, so, you know, but unfortunately, this whole process, you know, can take as long as 7 minutes. So for those of you that have this kind of system set up, you know what I'm talking about. Because I know with us, we have it for our offices, we have it for our home, and if there's an accidental activation, whatever the case may be, yes, they're calling us. But if they can't reach us, let me just tell you, if they can't reach us and they've already called the police department's going to be on their way, because I did this when I worked patrol. We get there. We search the outside of the perimeter of the house. We check the doors. We check the windows. Nothing. What happened? Person accidentally set off the alarm as they were leaving, didn't realize it because it goes off 30 seconds later, a minute later, and they've driven off. And now we're there on a call that's a wasted call when there could be another high-priority call. All right? Now, for those of you that have motion detectors, now, once again, you know, how do you look at that? You look at that as being a serious priority. Well, unfortunately, activated motion detectors don't meet an emergency. The dispatch centers give high priority to callers reporting a current home invasion. Active motion detectors without confirmation often turn out to be false. And once again, this gives them their lower priority. So as you can see, there's a lot of different ways that these things go. Now, for a domestic violence call in general, I want you to know, all right, because I want to back up on that a little bit. In the majority of cases, police respond to a domestic violence call. They normally try to do it within 10 minutes. But in 7% of the cases, the victim went to the police rather than the police coming to them. Okay? Now, what about robberies? Robberies often have a slight delay in police response time. That delay isn't due to the police. Since the situation is usually highly dangerous, bank personnel must use a silent alarm system. The police stations don't have the ability to monitor silent alarms. Instead, the bank has to trigger the alarm at an alarm company, then contact the police. And that time can range from 5 minutes to more than 10 minutes. So as you can see, these things are not just that simple. Now, you want to talk about an active shooter? In an active shooter situation, police respond in an average, I don't know, they say now maybe 3 minutes. But again, I caution that. That is one of the highest priority calls right now, but it depends upon so many other circumstances. How far is the police station away from where it's going, from where is the active shooter? How large is the facility where the police are responding to? All of those are factors. I always say in the trainings that the average active shooter time, 12 to 15 minutes. 12 to 15 minutes. Now, let's just change that to about the school shootings. Okay, because what I'm talking about with that is businesses. Now, the average police response times for school shootings, I will tell you that's being tracked, and according to the Department of Homeland Security, a school shooting lasts an average of 12 to 15 minutes, okay? 12 and a half minutes, really. The average police response time for this situation, believe it or not, is 18 minutes. Police around the country are trying to find ways to minimize this response time through technology. So the information I'm giving you on that is from the Department of Homeland Security. Now, if the active shooter situation, you know, takes, you know, 12 minutes, 12 and a half minutes, and a police response time is 18 minutes, you could see that that's problematic. That's why schools have got to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, I'm going to give you this last one. Quicker response time for home invasions. Look, you realize somebody's in your home and you immediately dial 911. Unfortunately, by the time they process the call and dispatch the police, unfortunately, the damage is already going to be done. So homeowners, you've got to understand that you've got to prevent the home invasion in the first place. And one of the most effective ways is with a security alarm. Look, you can put your alarm on. We put our alarm on night before we go to bed. The alarm is on. Okay, if anybody breaks into our house, home invasion, hey, the alarm is going to go off. Okay, so you can put them on when you're there and secure for the night. Now, the last one I'm going to tell you about are non-emergency calls. Look, you got to understand, no matter how panicked you may feel, it's simple that not every incident qualifies as an emergency. Police departments consider incidents non-emergency when the suspect is no longer there, some time has passed since the incident, so you get home, the burglary is already done, okay? We're not going to rush over there, okay? It's already done. If there's nobody's life in immediate danger, we're going to take a little bit longer to get there. It's not going to be considered a priority call, all right? Then you also have these things that the issue is about a nuisance. My neighbor's got the radio up too high. They're playing loud music over there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, look, once again, that's going to be a low priority call. Now, I got to cover a couple more with you because I want to give it to you by city because I know that this, you know, my broadcast goes out nationally. So I'm going to give you four major cities. Okay, about the average police response time. The first one that's near and dear to my heart, obviously, is Los Angeles. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, L.A. is a city known for its high crime levels, and luckily, the average police response time in L.A. is just about 5 to 7 minutes. Now, I know that some of you out there laughing and saying that, nah, this time when I've called them, it's taken a lot longer than that. Well, just take into consideration what I just told you, all right? So I'm giving you the average response time. And as I told you, that's going to depend upon the emergency. The next one is, what is the average police response time in Chicago? Chicago. Now, look, guys, all you had to do was watch the news, and you know there's a lot of issues in Chicago because Chicago definitely has its fair share of crime, especially gun violence that we've been hearing about. However, even with everything going on, they managed to keep their response time from a law enforcement standpoint from 3 to 4 minutes for priority calls. 3 to 4 minutes. That's pretty doggone good. Now, look, you know, again, take into consideration how many calls in Chicago that they're having, but they're saying that their response time is 3 to 4 minutes. You know, now, I'm going to give you two more. Detroit. Now, I'm going to tell you, unfortunately, Detroit always comes in with some of the longest police response times from my research. They're topping the charts, and you're not going to believe this, and I don't know if anybody from Detroit's listening to this or not. It's 58 minutes. 58 minutes. Can you believe that? They've got the worst response time. Why that is, I have no idea, but the research is showing that they're topping the charts at 58 minutes. No other city has even come close to that number. All right, not even New York, which is the fourth one. New York City, with all of its hustle and bustle, has a slightly elevated response time. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, New Yorkers have to wait an average of 9 minutes for police after a 911 call. But, you know, I mean, 9 minutes is not that bad, but I guess if you're the one that's in the middle of it, 9 minutes can actually seem like it's an eternity. Here's the bottom line. We all need to do our part to keep each other safe. Safeguarding your home is the first step. Knowing when it's okay to call 911 is another. And using the non-emergency line for non-life-threatening issues can help free up the line for true emergencies. That's what you have to keep in mind. And when an emergency does occur, we have to all remember that everyone is trying to do their best. for those of you that criticize the local police departments because they don't respond to your time, look, please take into consideration the things that I just talked about. And that's exactly why I wanted to do this piece, because, like I said, I get inquiries at the trainings. I get inquiries by emails about why it takes so long, you know, for the police to respond. And they are out there trying their best. You guys know that I do a lot on the air regarding, you know, police, et cetera. This is just one aspect of it. So I don't want to use the words, please be patient, but that's really what it boils down to. They can't be everywhere at once, all right? So take into consideration what I just gave you. Please understand that there's priority calls that we look at, and there's low priority calls. And even though you think your call is a high priority call, it may not be. Okay, the other area that I wanted to talk about today was understanding the different types of terrorism. Now, clearly, we're not going to get through all of this because we got through some information because of this hot topic of what happened in Virginia, et cetera, and then what happened at the Big Lots there in Texas as well. But this business about terrorism, because I get some emails where people inquire, you know, because aren't there different types of terrorism? And that part's true. Normally is what you hear people talking about is international terrorism and domestic terrorism. But I'm going to tell you that the first thing you need to understand is that the researchers in the United States, they really began to distinguish different types of terrorism in the 1970s. That's how far back it goes. And the reason for that was is that it followed a decade in which both domestic and international groups were really starting to flourish. By that point, modern groups have begun to use techniques such as hijacking, bombings, and you guys, right? Well, for those of you that are old enough to remember about hijacking planes, you know, that used to be a big deal. But anyway, hijacking, bombing, diplomatic kidnappings, and assassinations for these people to assert their demands. And then for the first time, they appeared as real threats to the Western democracies, you know, in the view of the politicians. So since the politicians and lawmakers and law enforcement and researchers all began to look at this back then, they are the ones that started coming up and saying, you know what, we got to take a serious look at this and go in a different direction and start classifying these things. Now, for those of you that have heard me speak before, what have I always told you? I mean, this business about domestic terrorism has been around since the late 1790s. But when they started taking a look and classifying these things, it's when they finally realized that we're moving in a direction where there's so many twists and turns that are happening with this that we have to be able to do something. Now, one of the things that you have not heard me talk about with terrorism, which is a developing major issue and concern, is bioterrorism. Bioterrorism. And again, we're not going to get to all of this today, so I'll pick it up next week. But bioterrorism refers to the international release of toxic biological agents to harm and terrorize civilians in the name of a political or other cause. Now, I can tell you that the United States Center for Disease Control has classified the viruses, bacteria, and toxins that could be used in an attack. You know, and they have these what they call Category A biological diseases, what are the most likely to do, you know, to do damage. So I'm not going to get into all of the different ones, because I don't want to throw a major scare into you guys with some of this. But I'm just telling you, that's one of the areas that we are really starting to look at a lot closer. And you've seen some of these things with anthrax and people sending things, you know, to poison people. And, you know, some of these politicians, something like that happened not too long ago. So this business of bioterrorism is something that we really need to take a look at. I'll tell you one more, and I'm going to be finished after that one. Look, they also have what they call narco-terrorism. And we really don't think about that. But, you know, that has to do with drugs, in all honesty. Now, I will tell you that Al-Qaeda is often said to finance its activities through drug trafficking. And way back when the 9/11 Commission report, that even noted, I don't know if any of you have ever read it, I've read the 9/11 Commission report, and it notes that while the drug trade was a source of income for the Taliban, it did not serve the same purpose for Al-Qaeda. And there's no reliable evidence that I just want to let you know that bin Laden, you know, when he was alive, was involved in or made his money through drug trafficking. Okay, so the narco-terrorism looks like it's very, very limited in terms of what it was doing. But, you know, you hear about things with the drug trades. You've heard about the Mexican cartels with some of this. You've heard that money is being sent overseas to fund terrorism. I think sometimes with all of this, we are our own worst enemies. Because guess what? If people stop buying these drugs, you know, this whole business about the drugs would, I don't want to say it'll completely disappear. I don't know. We'll just see. But, you know, but the critics of the prohibition of drugs say that it's in this prohibition itself which funds terrorism. So, you know, that's called narco-terrorism. So I've given you those two for this week. We'll cover it more extensively next week. All right? All right. You've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio, and it's unfortunately it's time to close out the show. But, you know, do me a favor. Be sure to join me next week. And if you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, be safe, but more importantly, be a reluctant victim. Until next week.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.